In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. As you know, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the world's favorite split infinitive. To boldly go where no man has gone before. I'm talking about Star Trek, and clearly you didn't know that it was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. I could not pretend to be a Trekker. Trekkie, I hear, is a pejorative term, so I'm familiar with the series and the franchise, just as anyone who grew up during the decades in which I grew up has to be, but not far beyond that. But the most iconic moment of Star Trek history, at least on the more popular scale, comes at the end of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I'm talking about the death of Spock, the Vulcan, who is a... I called him a Klingon earlier, and I heard from numerous Trekkers in the congregation that is a crime against humanity. At the end of The Wrath of Khan, what's happened is the Enterprise, which is their enormous spaceship, is under siege, and what's happened, the warp drive has somehow malfunctioned. And in order to escape danger, in order to survive, in order to keep going, someone has to go into the reactor core and vent the radiation somehow. There's a lot of mumbo jumbo, as there always is in Star Trek. But what comes down to it is that Spock says, "I'm going to go in." And he overpowers Dr. McCoy, and he goes in, and he flips the switch that needs to be flipped. And Captain Kirk, played by William Shatner, is comes in and realizes what's going on, and he's completely crestfallen. He sees his great friend and sort of first mate slump down. He pushes on the intercom, and Spock says the following. He says, "Do not grieve, Admiral. It is logical. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one." Then he places the Vulcan salute on the glass and says, "Live long and prosper," at which point he dies. It's a very powerful moment of self-sacrifice, actually. And not everything in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, stands up, but that definitely does. It is Christological in the extreme for a series that's not really known for its religious overtones. It's quite striking. Yet it is deeply in tension with this week's gospel reading that we just heard from Asher, which features two highly illogical parables. These are stories that Christ tells of people putting the bulk of their possessions at risk to recover a single lost item. In one case, a sheep, in another, a coin. Now, when you take these at face value, let's think about the lost sheep. Jesus is not trying to give us helpful hints on running a successful sheep ranching business. Not remotely. As Robert Capon put it, the most likely result of going off in pursuit of one lost sheep will be 99 more lost sheep. This is a quick way to lose all of your sheep. And it's a little confusing until you realize what Christ is doing, and that the 99 are a rhetorical device. No one who's ever heard that parable identifies with them. We all think of ourselves as the one lost sheep. Because to be human is to be lost. To be human is to be lost. Last year, the New York Times did a profile of the Ivy League, mental health on the Ivy League campuses. As you are probably aware, the instances of, or the diagnoses of mental illness on elite campuses has sort of experienced a very dramatic, sharp uptick in recent years. We're talking about depression, anxiety, but also, OCD and, bipolar disorder, all sorts of things. The mental health out there is not very good on campus, and so they were trying to figure out what was going on. And they interviewed a man at Cornell, Gregory Ells, who's the director of counseling and psychological services there. And he said that he believes that social media is a huge contributor to the misperception among students that their peers aren't also struggling. When students remark during a counseling session that everyone else on campus looks happy, he tells them, "I walk around and think that one's gone to the hospital, that one has an eating disorder, that student just went on antidepressants. As a therapist, I know that nobody is as happy or as grown up as they seem on the outside. Nobody is as happy or as grown up as they seem on the outside. Now, this is true, and it's true not just of college students. It's true of everyone. Every clergy person I've ever spoke to affirms that statement, that no one actually has it together inside, that everyone is lost. And part and parcel of that lostness seems to be the perception that you're alone in it. Everyone is lost, and everyone thinks they're alone in their lostness. Now, maybe you don't think of yourself as a completely lost person. That's more reserved for the sort of rebellious son or the estranged daughter. But perhaps it captures how you feel about some aspect of your life. Maybe your marriage or your career. You wake up one morning and you think, how did I get here? How did we get here? What wrong turn did we take? What is going on? Maybe you feel lost as a parent. You grow up thinking that one day you'll have things figured out with your kids the way that your parents did when you were growing up. Or perhaps you think that once you finally get to retirement age, well, then things will click into place and you'll be at peace with others and yourself. But that day just keeps getting further and further away, and you keep making it up as you go along. All the while you look around and everyone else seems to know what they're doing. They seem to have that roadmap, but you're lost. You never got the email with the address to plug into your GPS. You were somehow left off of it. And yet you're trying to fake it as though you do have the directions, as if Siri is telling you exactly where to go. So the first point of this sermon is simply that everyone is lost. No matter who you are, we all, like sheep, have gone astray, is how Isaiah puts it. And how that's incorporated in the Book of Common Prayer. Each of us has turned to our own way. This understanding that everyone is lost, is just as lost as you are, is the key to having compassion for other people who can't seem to ever get it together. It's the key to loving others and yourself. It's also the key to understanding the good news of grace, because these are not parables ultimately about sheep or coins. These are parables about the shepherd and the woman. These are parables about God's determination in going after the lost and the last. And it remains as counterintuitive today as it did when Jesus was speaking. Because, you know, when it comes to God, our default mode of thinking is the same. It never changes. We think, if only I weren't lost, then God would be interested in me. Once I finally get on the path, once I finally get sort of where I need to be going, well, then I can start going back to church and get that whole spirituality thing figured out. You know, once my kids are a little less rambunctious, well, then we can finally get to church. You know, we think that God is only interested in the path, in those who obey. And yet Christ represents the exact opposite of that. I mean, what's the context of these parables is hymns speaking to the Pharisees and scribes, religious authorities, who were grumbling about him welcoming sinners and tax collectors and eating with them. In other words, he's instantiating in his person, in that very setting, what these parables. He himself came to seek and save the lost. Christ was distinctly interested in the sinner and in the lost person. We need to be a little careful here, because the lostness in itself isn't redemptive, and anyone who feels lost in any area in which I've mentioned knows that it's not in and of itself the means to grace. Lostness is not benign. It's not romantic. We have a tendency to romanticize the outsider and the lost person, you know, the sort of the Kerouac kind of figure in American society. Yet sheep get lost when they're hungry and decide to leave the flock, when they think they can get what they need without the help of the shepherd, when they take control and go out on their own. Lostness is often a result of delusion and deceit and malice and stubbornness. And to be truly lost is to find yourself beyond the bounds of sympathy. Think about it, though. Like, how do we usually respond to our lostness in our own lives? Maybe you remember that great New Yorker cartoon of the family in the jungle, and the man is holding out a map, and he says, "Okay, I admit it, we're lost. But the important thing is to remain focused on whose fault it is." Right? That's where our mental energy needs to go. So when we're lost, we scramble for control. We try to put together, write up a better roadmap on the fly, come up with a fresh set of directions. And yet, if these parables are to be trusted, what we need in life is not a better roadmap. No, we don't need better directions. We need someone to come after us. Full stop. We need to be found. And, you know, this is the point of church, by the way. We are not here to provide you with, at least ultimately, we are not here to provide you with a more intricate or improved or more trustworthy roadmap for your life. We are here to remind you, week after week, to remind ourselves that God's attention is totally focused on lost people. So much so that he loses himself in the process. Because let's not forget, today is another anniversary, a more serious anniversary. It marks 15 years since the September 11th attacks. And there's a story, there's actually a new book that's come out called The Red Bandana that tells the story, and I think illustrates part of what I'm trying to talk about in terms of both lostness and the way that God responds. There's the story of Wells Crowther, a young man from Nyack, New York, who's just across the Tappan Zee Bridge, for those of you who know the tri-state area. And when he was 7 years old, when Wells was 7 years old, he was getting ready for church. He saw his dad had a pocket square. He said, "Dad, I'd like a pocket square too." So his dad said, "All right, I'll go get you a pocket square. But, you know, the pocket square is for decoration. You don't actually use that to blow your nose. So I'm going to give you a red handkerchief as well." So he has this red handkerchief, and it becomes a symbol of his link, his profound love for his father. And Wells would not, it turns out he like kept it on him at all times. He didn't go anywhere without it. He would use photographs of riding his bike with it in his back pocket. He was the lacrosse player. He actually went on to play Division I lacrosse. He has it tied around his lacrosse stick, but also under his helmet. It was a link to his dad. It wasn't the only link he had to his dad. See, his father was also a professional, but also a volunteer fireman and a firefighter in Nyack. And so Wells grew up at the firehouse, you know, polishing the trucks and helping the men. And when he got old enough, he too became a volunteer firefighter. When he graduated from Boston College in 1999, he went to work as an equities trader. And his office was on the 104th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. He didn't like it, though. And after 2 years, he called his father and he said, "Dad, I think I want to change my career. I've just submitted an application to become a New York City firefighter." In other words, Wells felt lost. He found himself where he didn't think he should be. And many of us have this sensation. We know what happens next. In the morning of September 11th at 9:03 a.m., that second plane cut a diagonal path between floors 78 and 84 of the South Tower. A little less than an hour later, the entire tower collapsed. And what went on in those, I think it's 56 minutes, is the source of a lot of journalism and a lot of interest. And let me tell you, Wells did not come out of the tower before it collapsed. But it wasn't the end of his story. See, 9 months after the attacks, the New York Times ran a detailed account of those who did make it out, of the survivors. What happened between the time the planes hit and the tower fell? Well, something strange came out in the reports of the survivors. Several survivors claimed that a mysterious man had appeared at an opportune moment, and his mouth and nose had been covered with a red handkerchief. Wells' parents read this and sent his picture to the survivors who reported it. And they confirmed that Wells was the guy with the red handkerchief. It turned out he had wrapped his face in that bandana to be able to breathe and to keep his face clear. And he just made his way down from the 104th floor via the only stairs that were intact to the 78th floor, which was the lobby where a lot of people were suffering enormously. You know, bodies everywhere and people in various amount of distress. When he got there, his training as a fireman kicked in, and he called out, said, you know, "I know the way down. If you can stand, stand now." And he started to take people down to the 71st, to the 61st floor. We find out that one victim was too weak to make the descent, so he carried her on his back. Once he got down to the 61st floor, where there were working elevators taking people down to the lobby and they could get out, instead of going with them, he said, "I'm going back up." And he went back up, we think possibly three times. He's credited with saving 12 people. When they discovered his body 6 months after the attacks, it was found in the lobby of the South Tower, surrounded by uniformed firefighters. As one writer describes it, Wells was 75 feet away from the rest of his life, but he didn't make that walk. Instead, he stayed to help. You see, Wells Crowder wasn't lost after all. He was right where he needed to be. The lesson here, though, is not that we all could or should be Wells Crowder. Yes, that would be wonderful. The lesson is more that Wells gives us a glimpse both of ourselves and how God relates to us in the midst of our lostness. Remember, he is both here the victim of the enormous destructive force of the world coming at him. But not only the victim of it in sitting on the 104th floor, but he is the rescuer from it. And that is unique. When one of the survivors was interviewed, you know, "Wells Crowder saved my life," is what she said. "Unfortunately, his father and mother had to lose him in order to save me." So what I'm saying is that this evening, if you were lost, if you think everyone else around you knows what they're doing, but you feel lost, if the walls feel like they're crumbling around you, well, take a deep breath, because that's actually good news. You see, your lostness is all that the Good Shepherd requires of you. You are, it turns out, an occasion for joy and celebration. And yet at the same time, if that red bandana tells us anything, it's that you may not be as lost as you think you are. You may be right where you need to be. Now, just like Wells' story was not over when the tower fell, neither was Spock. Because you all know what happened in Star Trek 3. What's it called? The Search for Spock. Your expressions are wonderful. In Star Trek 3, the crew of the Enterprise hears a rumor that Spock is actually survived somehow. He's been resurrected through some arcane Vulcan ritual. And when they hear this, this is so wild, and yet it sounds credible. And so they decide to drop everything. They throw away their careers, and they all become outlaws to go and find Spock. To go and get him. And they finally find him. And he has no idea who they are, because his memory has been erased. But then through the miracle of mind melds, he realizes who these people are. And with the help of his father, he sees Jim Kirk, Captain Kirk, and he says, "My father says that you have been my friend. You came back for me. Why would you do this?" And Kirk looks at him and says, "Because, my friend, the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many." Amen.